Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. How do you get to be the best of the best? New Orleans author Kit Wall has a special perspective on that, having just compiled the 25th anniversary retrospective of the James Beard Foundation's Best American Chefs. Chef Philip Lopez knows a bit about that too, having worked with some of the best chefs in the world before opening his ambitious new restaurant, Root. And John Besh is looking for America's best new chefs, and he wants them to be Louisiana homegrown. There's a whole lot of cooking going on this week's Louisiana Eats. Chef Philip Lopez has created a playground for molecular gastronomy at his new restaurant in New Orleans Warehouse District, Root. Okay, Chef, let's get to the root of this. Will you show us your kitchen?
Absolutely. So if we could take a look in here, we have a bunch of equipment. Now, it may look like a standard kitchen to you guys. In all actuality, every kitchen's got to have certain equipment that you're going to need to cook, you know, food. And so it's all about the organization. And we have smokers back there. We have dehydrators. We have cotton candy machines. We have immersion circulators. Eventually, we're moving into the position to where, you know, we'll have liquid nitrogen here to do some things, some fun little quirky dipping dots and stuff for dessert. But at the end of the day, it's all about real food, and that's what we try to serve here. But, you know, the molecular gastronomy part of it is really just the fun quirkiness that runs through my head.
Give me some examples, if you would. Okay, so you've described some of your toys to us. Now, tell us how you play with those toys and what you do with them.
Well, I teach these guys that everything that they put their hands on, whether it be a piece of parsley or a loaf of foie gras, everything has to be utilized in more than one way. And especially in this economy right now, you want to be able to cross-utilize your products. So when it comes to parsley, we would pick the leaves off the parsley. We would juice the parsley. We would take the stems and we would sous vide them, actually, and then dehydrate them and grind them up into powders. And so you're able to stretch your items a little bit further, but yet you're also creating more textures and different variables within the food. And so I can make a parsley-scented ravioli, but then also have parsley powder on the plate, parsley paint to paint the plate with. So there's different aspects to all these ingredients. And we always talk about how it doesn't matter the actual value that you pay for your ingredient. Everything's on the equal, same playing field. And so whether it be a peach or a lobster tail, they're both as equal a value in the kitchen as anything else. And so it is your job as a chef to make sure that you create this dish surrounding this peach to make it as awesome as this lobster. And that, you know, that is our job as a chef every day in this kitchen, and that's what we strive for.
Okay, let's discuss some of your menu items in particular. And I know you've got a fish dish that you garnish with pine needle pearls. Yeah. What are pine needle pearls, and how do you make them?
Well, to tell you the truth, these pine needle pearls are actually made from spherification. There's a company based out of California that I get a lot of assistance from. Now, there's a machine, it's called a rotovap, which is really more like of a distillery. And so I can take items such as pine and distill it into an essence. And so this company produces these essences for me, and then I can take this pine essence and flavor different ingredients. So we make this pine stock, and then we add chemicals to it in order to make these little pearls. And so we add the stock to a syringe, and then we pipe the little pearls into a calcium bath, which creates this small little gelatin sphere outside and then this little gooey, ooey texture on the inside. And then so we add another stabilizer to that in order for us to heat it up in a pan. And it's quite interesting, the texture of it, because it's almost like pine caviar.
It is. Yeah. It is.
And there's also another method, too, that we use, and we use a type of tapioca starch, and we create our own tapioca pearls using pine essence into that, too, as well. So
one of the biggest surprises I ever found on the dinner table was a cigar box. And inside that cigar box were Cohiba smoked scallops. Yeah. Now, how do you get the smoke in there?
Well, we use a little tool called the smoking gun, and you can find it anywhere. You can find it at Williams-Sonoma. You can order it online, and it's a little handheld device, and you can put all kinds of different ingredients in it. You can put wood, a cigar. Sometimes you can put dehydrated mint leaves and, you know, different ingredients. And so we tried to play around with different items to smoke with, and, you know, growing up, my father used to smoke cigars before I was born, and so it kind of gave me the inspiration to use cigar smoke in this dish. And, you know, I've always been outward thinking, outside of the box, and so anytime I go into the outside world, and I mean outside of the kitchen, I always try to find items and different tools to use as a presentation or as a vessel for the dish. And it just so happened that the smokiness of the cigar and the sweetness of the scallop work hand in hand, and, you know, to serve it in a cigar box, I mean, why not?
That's a crazy, crazy thing. Now, speaking of crazy things, tell us about the wild things that you're up to with foie gras.
Oh, my gosh. One of the fun ideas I got from the chefs at El Bulli, they were turning different kinds of fats into spun sugar. So they were taking olive oil and making it into, you know, olive oil cotton candy or olive oil sugar, and kind of blew my mind. And so,
could you possibly break down for me what the heck you're talking about? How do you do that?
Well, you have to use a certain type of sugar and a certain type of chemical to stabilize the sugar and the fat. Like if you're making a caramel at home, Poppy, you know, you take your sugar, you bring it up to a hard crack stage, and then you incorporate cream and butter and all that good stuff into it. Well, this is the same philosophy. It's just a little bit more refined and a little bit more on a molecular stage, because you're actually taking chemicals and mixing it with other items in order to incorporate the two together. Now, anybody would have thought, man, how can you put foie into sugar? Because it's like a fat substance. Well, it's almost like making a vinaigrette. You're taking a vinegar and you're taking an oil and you're emulsifying it together. So we take this foie fat, which we render out, and so it's in a liquid state. We add a chemical to that, and then we take sugar and we add a chemical to that. Now, those two chemicals and each ingredient will help stabilize the two together. And so we bring them both up to a certain temperature, we combine the two together, and voila, we have a foie caramel.
And how do you serve that?
Well, believe it or not, we take that foie caramel, okay, and we break it up and we grind it into a powder to make a candy. That we spin in a cotton candy machine. So now we have foie gras cotton candy. Now, that's all great and all, but we have to put a little bit more substance inside of it. So what we did is we took a foie mousse, which we studded with strawberry pop rocks, and then we wrapped the whole thing in foie cotton candy. So now you have essentially a foie lollipop. Is what I like to call it. Everyone's grown up eating lollipops, and so this is a little bit more of a grown-up style lollipop right here.
That's wild. Okay, let's move on to dessert.
Oh.
You're making your own Cocoa Puffs?
Yes, we are. Now, the actual technique I cannot release, because there's been so many people trying to get this recipe. Now, I have to say it involves corn flakes, okay? Uh-huh. It has to involve dark chocolate and dark cocoa powder. And so there's a technique that we use to incorporate that, and we make Cocoa Puffs from the cornflakes. We then wrap it or coat it in the dark chocolate. You know, being a chef, we work constantly. We do long hours. And so when we go home at the end of the night, we really don't feel like cooking. So this dish is actually inspired by the lack of having ingredients in your house to make food. And usually I have a box of cereal and some milk, so I'm always eating a bowl of cereal when I go home. So I'm thinking, why can't I incorporate that into a dessert? And so I got the idea, actually, for my fiance. Her favorite thing to eat is mint chocolate chip. And so I said, wow, Cocoa Puffs, mint chocolate chip. I think we have something here, you know. So we actually take the Cocoa Puffs. We serve it with mint chocolate chip ice cream. We do a house-made York peppermint patty. And then we serve it with minted milk. To mix all that together is just absolutely amazing.
What inspires your work?
Everything inspires me. I mean, from the moment I wake up to the moment I go to sleep, I mean, every second of the day is an inspiration. And whether it's a flash of light or whether it's, you know, different colors put together, everything has to be an inspiration. It's weird, because sometimes a dish just comes to me, or it comes to us in the kitchen, and we're all sitting there talking, goofing around, and then somebody brings up the idea of steak tartare, and then I'm like, oh my God, what if we could do this, or what if we could do that, and what if we can change this and turn it around? And so it's really a culmination of my teachings and my philosophy, and then everyone's ideas put together. And I love this restaurant because it gives us the opportunity to just play around with so much stuff.
I want to thank you so much for sharing some of your scientific tricks you've got going on in the kitchen here.
It was my pleasure, Poppy. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Chef Philip Lopez, playful scientist and chef at his restaurant playground, Root.
I can't get enough. I try. Oh, that funky stuff. I say, whoa, 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 yeah. Get down.
And now it's time for our Louisiana Eats Culinary Quiz Question of the Week. Brought to you with support from French Market Coffee. The correct answer to last week's question, what is the name of the smiling baker found on every Hubig's pie bag, is Savory Simon, named for the company's founder, Simon Hubig. Now let's see who this week's lucky winner is. Thomas Walsh, our Louisiana Eats producer, is manning the grinder.
Well, my thanks to all the listeners who fought back the Ash Wednesday blues to participate in our culinary contest. I just hope our winner isn't giving up coffee for Lent, because three heaping bags are headed their way shortly. Congratulations to Sheila Connolly of New Orleans, Louisiana. You've won this week's contest. We hope you'll share in the excitement this coming week.
This week's question is for all of our Louisiana hunters. What is the name of the waterfowl deemed proper for Lenten consumption by fasting French Creoles of the 18th and 19th centuries? Send your answers to Louisiana Eats at wwno.org by midnight Sunday night. All correct answers received will be mixed together in our French Market coffee grinder, and one lucky winner will be chosen at random and announced on next week's show. Again, this week's question is, what is the name of the waterfowl deemed proper for Lenten consumption by fasting French Creoles of the 18th and 19th centuries? Email those answers by midnight Sunday night to Louisiana Eats at wwno.org with culinary quiz in the subject line, and you could be next week's lucky winner. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Award-winning author, photographer, and artist Kit Wall could herself be described as the best of the best. Kit's eight previous books all celebrate cuisine and her beloved New Orleans. It's a hard call to know what is more enticing, Kit's engaging prose or her luscious food photography. No wonder that the James Beard Foundation chose Kit to author the new book, The Best of the Best, a 25th anniversary celebration of America's outstanding chefs. Kit, tell us how this book even came about.
Well, the outstanding chef that's named every year by the Beard Foundation is the top chef in America. And in the 25 years of the foundation, they began the awards 3 or 4 years into it. Mm-hmm. So there are 22 at this point. And they began with Wolfgang Puck. He was the first. He was Los Angeles. Then it started moving toward San Francisco for awards with Alice Waters and Jeremiah Tower and Judy Rogers, all fabulous chefs. Then Chicago has a few, Washington has a few, and New York has many. Tracing the evolution of these chefs over a 25-year period really gives us a trajectory of how our food in America evolved and is celebrated as regional cuisines now.
So what went into conducting these interviews? You went to the city where they lived, went into their kitchens, and describe how many days did you spend? What was the actual process like?
The actual process, the physical process of being with the chef, was generally 2 or 3 days. And we would go in with a crew and the photographer. We'd talk with the chef and work out the dishes that we were going to review that he wanted or she wanted in the book. So we had a chef with us, Chef Robert Barker, who was a New Orleanian, and they would cook the dishes, and we'd set them up for photography, shoot them, and then I'd spend a couple of hours with the chef doing an interview, and then we'd get to eat what we shot. And, you know, eat what you kill is the rule. So,
well, that all sounds like a really delicious process. I'm curious, how were the recipes selected?
The chefs chose what represented their work the best.
Okay. And I'm kind of curious, because these are the best of the best, so can a home cook actually reproduce these dishes?
Absolutely. We did here in New Orleans when we got back. That was the second stage of the process. And I'm fortunate to have several college students on a rotating basis. And they don't want to have cooking skills when they come to work with us. I'd like them to be able to follow a recipe accurately as a non-cook. So the objective was a recipe anyone can make.
So you were on this fantastic whirlwind tour of these kitchens. I'm curious, did you find them to be similar? What were some of the similarities in the workspaces of these people?
Everything from Alice's warm and friendly home, I felt like I was in my own kitchen, to Michel Richard's, where you could commit surgery. It was so clean. But he's such a hoot. He's a funny man. You know, he would flick bread balls at us while we were working. And then everything all across the board, from just top drawer shiny stainless steel to really fundamental cooking, good cooking. Judy Rogers at Cafe Zuni, or Zuni Cafe, is all out there in the open. And a guest could literally walk up and stand next to her while she roasts the chicken.
Tell me, Kit, what did you learn in the process of writing this book?
I learned that each one of these chefs were completely different because of their time and place and what drove them to cooking and their passion, but really their fundamental insistence on detail and consistency. They were tremendously committed to what they do. Fascinating to me was the cross-pollination that began occurring with notably Wolfgang Puck, who received the award first. He was a European who came to America to do better and couldn't find the products that he used in France. There you would go down the road and get a lamb or vegetable or whatever products you wanted fresh for your establishment. Here, that wasn't possible. It was post-World War II, which my mother embraced. If it came in a box.
Or a can. They loved that.
TV dinner and Swanson's. You know? Anyway, Wolf and many other European chefs came to America, and at the same time, because we didn't at the time have many culinary schools, a lot of our forward-thinking American chefs were going to Europe to make their bones and learn about food. So they came back, and everyone got together and started cross-pollinating, and regional cuisine emerged. Mm. So you start with Wolfgang Puck and Alice Waters and Jeremiah Tower and Paul Prudhomme, who in New Orleans was doing his own movement. They were making things happen at the farm level. So what was new then is new again. We're celebrating once again the availability of fresh product, but now we have farmers and purveyors and people who delight in providing these elements.
Well, it's a wonderful trip. I'm envious of your real trip, and I'm so glad I can take it vicariously with you in this book.
Well, you need to take it. You can take a pilgrimage. It's a very simple trip.
Thank you, Kit.
Thank you.
Kit Wall, author of the James Beard Foundation's Best of the Best. You're simply the best. Better than all the rest. Better than anyone. Anyone I ever met. Last year, Chef John Besh joined forces with Jessica Bride to form the Chef's Move Scholarship. Previously on Louisiana Eats, we met the first scholarship recipient, Serena Johnson. Chef's Move is now accepting applications for year two, and joining us to talk about that process is Executive Director Emery Whalen.
Emery, how are you?
I'm wonderful. How are you, Poppy?
I'm great. And tell me, how is our friend Serena doing?
Serena is just amazing. I admire her so much, and I am so grateful to have her as our first scholarship recipient. She's up in New York at the International Culinary Center. You can really tell she's already making her mark on the culinary community.
So tell us, what's new this year with Chef's Move?
This year, we are thrilled to announce that we are adding a second scholarship in pastry, so we'll be able to send off two recipients to New York in the fall.
Who qualifies for a scholarship?
Minority applicants with a GED and 1 year of experience in a professional kitchen, or they could have come through the ProStart program.
What is a ProStart program?
ProStart program is the Louisiana Restaurant Association's training program for high school students.
Okay. Are there geographic limitations?
They need to be from New Orleans.
From New Orleans. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you're basically looking for somebody with a little bit of background in the kitchen who has a deep love for it already and the potential to go further.
Exactly. And what we want to do is just give them the tools that they need to harness that potential and take it to the next level.
Well, if anybody can do it, I know Chef John Besh can get it done. I want to thank you so much for telling us this exciting news, and I hope everybody listening finds the right applicants for you all.
Thank you so much, Poppy, for helping us spread the word.
Emery Whalen, Executive Director of John Besh's Chef Move Scholarship. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us on Friday, March the 23rd, for a live taping of Louisiana Eats. Our special guests are Lynn Rosetta Casper of Splendid Table and Road Foods' Jane and Michael Stern. Visit WWNO.org for more information. Next week, we sit down with Bizarre Foods' Andrew Zimmerman. Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at WWNO.org. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from French Market Coffee and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan's Steakhouse, Palace Cafe, and the Bourbon House, Lights Egan Funeral Homes, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Cooking Magazine. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO.